from growing up and, you know, coming in and big old Victorian house, dark, cold. My mum was dead. Sister got married. The other one was in, she was the school swat, so the nuns gave her tea and she stayed till late. So I'd come in and make the fire and see what food was around and cook myself a thing and then listen to Radio Luxembourg and read a book because it was no one to do, make me do homework. So that's, the, you know, I didn't feel like that, but retrospectively, it was and I was lonely. I mean, it was a small little chap, you know, I was lonely.
You mentioned your mum there. Your mum died when you were 7.
Yeah.
And your last memory of her sounds sweet, where you were sitting on her knee.
Mum was sitting in the bay window with a mate and said bedtime, I think, you know. And so I jumped up on her knee for a cuddle before bed and then like off to bed. And then in the morning, my dad came in and sat in the bed and he said, I've got something terrible to say to you. And I got a bit scared. I remember this very well. And then he started crying and he said, your mum's dead. And I'd never seen my father cry. And that freaked me out. That's the thing that freaked me out, like, you know. And I started crying because my father was crying. Means the universe has shattered. This man, this big man who does everything, he's crying. And so then I heard all this noise downstairs and so all the family were there, the uncles and aunts. And I go down and they're all going, you know, solicitous and the women are crying and my dad is shock. And I get out the white Nazi helmet we had. It was a Nazi helmet, but it was painted white to exorcise the ghosts. And I went across the road to play Second World War, I suppose, with Jackie Kennedy, the young girl across the road. That's it. That was it.
See, I had my dad's dead now. My mum's still alive. I had both of them until my mid-30s. Yeah. Do you think you missed anything losing a mum? I see parents as two really solid pillars in my life. I don't think I'm going to survive without them.
I mean, you know, they're the polar. They're the poles around which childhood revolves. There's no question about that. It was a removal of both. Because my dad, as I say, went away on a Monday and came back on a Friday selling his towels and rugs and things.
Is it true you didn't have a good relationship with your dad?
I didn't because my dad's thing was just get a job. Just hold on to it. No matter what humiliation, no matter what they do, just hold on to it. Because he was from the 20s, you know, where there was no jobs. I mean, people talk about the Great Depression of the 30s and the Great Recession of now. In the Great Depression, there weren't jobs because there was only the shipyards or the factory. There wasn't any other job. If you lost that, goodbye. A couple of mom and pop stores, that was it. There was no middle class economy. So he came from that. He clung on to his job.
That's the normal type of conflict, though, between a father
yes,
and
a is,
son.
Yes, but
isn't
also
it?
The rupture then of the culture, you know, where you just rejected all of that because the economy was changing. Now you could move around. So he didn't get that. He insisted that I do well in school. The more he insisted, the more I kicked against him. The surviving parent is always to blame. Who else do you kick against?
To blame for your mother's death.
To blame for everything. Whatever it is. The loneliness, the poverty, you know, the embarrassment of our house, the everything. I mean, you know, it's awful. Anyway, he was paying money to educate his 3 children. I was rejecting that out of hand. I was a low burning pain in the arse in school. You know, like in the class, like, you know, doing not overt things, but things that would, you know, the teacher would be, where are you at, Geldof? You know, that sort of thing. And, you know, stupid things like, you know, always thrown out and stuff. So, and I was contrarian to the nth. And I started anti-apartheid, you know, to block the Springboks tour of Ireland with Mick Foley. And then stopped going home at all, just worked with the sign community all night outside here. That was more interesting to me.
And yet you went on to make your dad really proud with what you achieved in your life, presumably.
Yeah, he was. And, you know, we were great friends for most of our lives, you know. I mean, he began to understand the boy, even if the boy didn't really understand himself. And I understood who he was anyway from the get-go.
Did he ever tell you he was proud of you?
All the time, yeah. Not all the time. What?
That matter to you?
Not as much as you see in American movies, you know.
See, why? Where's this hard man coming from?
No, it's not a hard man. Like, you know, he didn't say it. He wasn't incontinent. We're a very emotional family, Europeans. Like, here's my grandparents on my dad's side. Belgian Catholic, English Jewish. Mother's side, Irish nothing, German proddy, you know. So luckily I got the Irish nothing, you know, out of that stew. And we always kissed men, cuddled, you know, when we met uncles, cousins, kissed, still do. My dad always cuddled. And so that was it. But like when he'd say the odd time, he'd say, good man, he'd say like that, you know, especially if like there was a politician and he'd see me on television, he'd just say, good man, you know.
I guess in interviews like this, you get into personal territory. And if this is, just push me away, we'll move on. But you mentioned loneliness on a number of occasions through this interview.
Yeah.
And do you get any more lonely when the person you love leaves you? Is what's in my head, well, just when you mentioned that.
Are you talking about Paula?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, well, I just went into meltdown, which I think boringly, you know, I don't mind talking about this stuff because guys won't talk about it, and they should. And they're often not capable of it, but, you know, I just never shut the up, as you know. So, and you've probably seen me on other shows go on about it, so it's dull. But I think what happened was...
Can you describe... What you don't know about me is I made a documentary last year on depression,
yeah,
and mental ill health, mm, and men talking about, you know, meltdown and, okay, and emotional trauma.
Well, I'd like to see that.
Can you tell me what you meant by meltdown? This powerful, towering, driven figure. What do you mean by meltdown?
To the point where I thought it was better not to exist. Where I thought better now to kill myself than to go on. I didn't want to wake up another day like this. That was one morning. And
had you thought it through?
Yeah. Being me, I thought it through. I made, on a notebook, I put, you know, reasons to continue. Reasons not to, which took up a page. Reasons to continue the children. But they weren't enough. Figure that. And I called my mate, Pat. And I said, I just can't go on now. And Phil Davison, an Irish writer, some mates helped me through all this. Pete Briquette in The Rats. Phil Davison, writer from Dublin. Pat Savage, who's accounted for most of the rock bands, you know. Godfather to his kid, godfather to mine. Johnny Maguire, a BBC director. These guys literally lived with me, stayed with me, cooked. That's how I was incapable. And so I called Pat. Philo was living in the house at the time and he just didn't know what to do. And I wasn't railing or anything. I just thought, and I'd woken up with this, I mean, you know, again, you know, sorry if this happens to you, but you'll understand it. I thought heartbreak was a metaphor, a country and western type metaphor. I didn't understand it was a physical thing that actually does shrivel the heart and that your bone structure and your muscle structure, that there's a physical pain. But there was this great, great chasm here and a sort of abyss of loneliness, a sort of universe of pain, oceans of loss. And I was crying in my sleep. And I wake up with tears streaming down my face. And that was the point where there's no escape even in sleep. utter exhaustion doesn't do it anymore. And I thought, I just can't wake up with this physical pain and another day. And Pat just said, you stay exactly where you are. And he came around and he just, you know, he gave me such a... And I know that that isn't the approved way, but, you know, Paddy's like, you know, what the f*** are you playing at? You know, it's like, you listen to me, pal. And it was, you know, probably what I needed.
Was it the thought of betrayal?
No.
Was it the loss?
Of Paula?
Yeah.
No, what I think happened, because, and like this, you know, people have written about this, which is kind of odd. It's your life, you know, but we just talked about my mum. And so that was it, that morning when I went over to play with Jackie and that. And then on the day mum was buried, I was taken to see the Kings of Comedy with Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, all that. Because children, at least, I don't know if they did, but I don't think children went to the funerals, you know. Now, of course, it's, hey, closure, you know. And so they go along. But that was it. Suddenly you've got a mother and suddenly you haven't. But the thing is that finality, the Americans always get closure, but they don't get finality. Finality didn't really strike me then. And when I started becoming a man at 11, 12, 13, when you have that utter confusion of puberty, boys and girls, you know, about what the hell are you and that, and it manifests itself in all sorts of dangerous ways often, there wasn't anyone to steer you. And I used to tangibly want somebody. When I was in trouble in school, and I'd come home on the bus with my report card, I'd sort of pray to my mother, you know, to get me out of this. So clearly I wanted that other part there. So that person isn't there. I don't have any sort of family growing up. Dad's away, mum's dead, sister's married, the other one's in school. So you bring yourself up largely. Then you go off to a very unwelcoming world to try and make your own way through it. And soon you find yourself, for no apparent reason, in a rock and roll band. And suddenly turns out you can write songs. And next minute, you're a rock and roll star.
And he can see no reasons, because there are no reasons. What reason do you need to be shown? Tell me why. I don't like Mondays. Tell me why. I don't like Mondays. Tell me why.
But before I get to be a rock and roll star, I'm in London. And I'm happening, and I got a record out, and people are suddenly fating you, and there's a party for us. And here's this unbelievably beautiful girl, and she comes up to you and she's talking and she's seriously funny, bright, beautiful, and you kind of go, hold on, I couldn't get shagged a week ago in Dublin, and like, here's this gorgeous thing, you know. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not, you know, hold on, I've just started this rock and roll lark, you know, I'm gonna shag the planet here, I'm gonna, you know, like, it's boy stuff. And it didn't turn out like that. Having very little confidence, and yet with this spectacular woman on your arm, it gave me all the confidence to allow this lumpen piece of lead to soar. And so we created our own family out of nothing, you know, out of really nothing, you know, and became very locked into our own world. And then she goes. And suddenly all the stuff that didn't happen to me when my mother died, when you're a kid and don't understand it, I imagine, amateur psychology, Nolan, I imagine that bang, you know.
Yeah, but she didn't just go, as in die, she left you. And when I asked you if there was a sense of betrayal and you said no, it must be different. No. It must be different, someone you love dying, and someone you love choosing to leave you.
No,
it must be.
No, I mean, someone falls out of love with you, it happens.
Come on, you're being logical and rational about something that...
No, but I explained to you how irrational I became. So allow me to reason now why that happened. It happened out of the blue. Out of the blue. You know, maybe I am completely thick. You know, another man, another woman would have probably seen the signs. I didn't. And you know, the marriage thing was a big thing with me. It took me a long time to get my head around getting married. When I said the words, well, I meant it. Once I say I'll do something, and once I say in front of everyone, I don't need my relationship sanctified by the state or God, believe me. But once I say it, I mean it. And I meant it. If I'm doing it for life, I'm in. I'm in. Okay, that's it. So all that comes in. And it's, you know, Irish Catholic thing, maybe. I don't know. Whatever. But that's it. So, and then she leaves out of the blue, just like your mother, out of the blue. Now, I'm not conflating the two, but it's possible that the grieving was to such an intensity. But the truth is that at the time was the loss of my family that I'd never had. All the warmth in my life were these people. Why were they taken from me? What had I done? And I just wanted...
Did you ever find out the answer to that?
Well,
had you done anything?
No. She just fell out of love with me. It happens. And there's no coming back. There's no going to things and saying, yeah, well, if I try this, will you love me again? I can change. You can't change. And it isn't about change anyway. You fall out of love. And there was weird stuff going on with her, as we subsequently know. It became, pardon the expression, it sounds too grand, Shakespearean, but what else can you call it when two of the three people involved in this die? You know, from that point then, I just wanted to be with my children.
Do you ever fully recover, or does it
leave? Yeah, you do. I mean, how serious was I? I didn't do it, so that would tend to a lack of seriousness. The fact that I called Pat, you know. But it was a madness, Stephen. It really was. I mean, outside the door were at least 40 journalists a day. And one of the papers had hired the house ops and there were just cameras. So I just kept the curtains closed.
That's pressure.
The house was bugged because I had the house swept.
The house was bugged?
Yeah, it was bugged.
So obviously we've been talking about phone hacking recently. The house was bugged?
The house was bugged, yeah. The phones were bugged. The landlines were bugged.
You're coming to Belfast on Friday. Why get it back together again? Why not?
Age, curiosity and cash, you know. Enough time had passed. I tried out other stuff. You know, I do a lot of gigs with my own crowd. John Giddings, who was one of the Rat's old promoters, bumped into Gary, the guitar player, and said, would Geldof ever consider doing something? Because I don't know. He says, well, if you ever, you should speak to him. I'd put you on at the Isle of Wight. So that really was it. Like, you know, when Gary called me, I would have said, oh, I don't know. But he said, it's the Isle of Wight. I said, my vanity, you know, because I'd been there. I'd seen Leonard Cohen and Jimi Hendrix and The Doors and The Who at the first or second Isle of Wight. And then I said, well, how much, you know? So that was the cash. So that was excellent, always handy. And then the curiosity, you know, were we any good? You know, is that a fond imagining of mine? And so those three factors. So we got together, sheepish grins all around, you know, and started playing. And then I started singing the words of looking after number one. The world owes me a living, was the first line you ever heard me say. And I thought, yeah.
And what if, you talked about those fond memories. It's a gamble, isn't it? Because what if, when you get back again, it didn't feel the same? It wasn't the same?
The memories. I didn't want to relive the memories. I wanted to live now. The disappointment is that I genuinely thought our generation would change things, certainly in Ireland, in the Republic. This devilarian notion of statehood. Awful. No time for it whatsoever. A failure. Church-state compact. No time for it. And it led to great abuse. It led to, in my view, a brutalised society. And people hate me going on like this. But the police just believe they could pull you off the street, beat you up. You go to the Christian Brothers, they beat you up. the kids dispatched to the laundries or the orphanages beaten up. The church, when they weren't keeping quiet about the killers in the north, busily abusing the children of their parishioners. The government, when they weren't selling off desert zoned land, lending at least tacit support to some of the killers up in the north. A civil war in our own island, which we euphemistically call the Troubles. It's not a trouble when there's murder committed on 3.2 thousand people on your own tiny speck of the planet. That's not a trouble. Call it what it is.
But when you get on that stage again, and with all of that depth that you have in your head, presumably you're enjoying it too. Presumably it's nice to be up there performing.
It's cathartic as anything, you know. I mean, you know, that's what the Rats set out to articulate. You don't know it because you're brought up in the north. You had your own stuff. But here there was this claustrophobia of silence. We knew this stuff. So, you know, you can't point at Haughey and, you know, you can't, because we knew. And we shut up. And I wasn't going to shut up. And I met other guys who just went Geldof, but they provided the raw power that propelled these songs to the top of the charts. Who'd have thought? You know, I'm writing Rat Trap and Meat Factory. How do I get out of this, you know? It's number one.
Listen, grind, ooze from its gap-busting zone. The screaming and crying in the high-rise block. It's a rat trap, get it, but you're already...
So when I'm on that stage, I feel ashamed that my generation failed, angry at us and myself that we did. And the songs are as now as any moment I could have written. I wouldn't have changed a word if I'd written them yesterday.
And you're also going into space.
Yes, I am. And you wouldn't fit in the capsule. You know, what can I say? Yeah, like they came to me. October the 5th is my birthday. And I was in Africa doing a thing. And we got a gig at the Natural History Museum in the UK, in London. I said, oh man, you know, I'm in Africa. How much, you know, again? And they said, and I said, no. Like, it was, you know, it's not even close. So they got close. So I was forced to ring the others, you know, and said, listen, we're being offered this. You know, it's not what we normally go for. They said, okay, we'll do it. So I said to them, yeah, okay, we'll do it. But I said, I'm in Africa, man. It's my birthday on the 5th. I said, well, we give you a birthday as well as that. I said, I know, but I have to come back overnight on the 4th. I'll be knackered and all that. And they said, well, we've no more money, Bob, you know. I said, well, it's not great, you know. I said, we've no more money, but we've got a lot of sponsors. I said, well, so what? And they said, well, maybe we can chuck something in. I said, like what? And they said, well, do you fancy going to space? So I went, yes, you know. And I said, well, send me the stuff. And they sent me the link. And, you know, Dan Dare, like, it looks exactly like Dan Dare. And so I started training last week. Branson was sick. He saw me in South Africa. He said, why are you doing this? I said, because you never asked me. He goes, but you never asked me. And I said, and if I did, you'd have said 250 grand, Richard, you know. And he said, well, I'd put four Irish people up before you. And I said, yeah, sure, if you ever get there, you know. So that's it. But wouldn't you say yeah?
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I stood out with my dad on the steps of our house in Black Rock in the 50s. And he turned up the radio loud so we could hear Sputnik. You know, and the radio was saying, and at 8:55, the Sputnik will be going over and, like, have a look out. And I beep, beep. And we stood out there. I was about 5 or 6 or something. We stood out and, like, I remember just looking up and looking through the gap in the cloud, and there it was. I just saw it and the beep coming off the radio. And I'd be that little shiny light.
You're one of the most interesting, intriguing guests I've ever spoken to. Thank you.